Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 11 years of law enforcement analysis experience with 26 years of law enforcement experience overall. She's an instructor, a former probation officer, and a fan of bourbon. Representing the big state of Texas, please welcome Krista Whitehead. Krista, how are we doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. Well, first of all, I want to say I'm very happy that you survived your accident on Sunday.
Oh, man, it was something else.
Yeah, it's not every day that my guest not only starts a new job in the same week that I'm interviewing them, but they also get into a pretty serious car accident on the Sunday before.
Yeah, it was terrifying.
You saw the pictures for the audience. She got T-boned at an intersection, flipped over and everything else. I can't believe you just walked away with just a little bit of bruise on the shoulder, you said, right?
Yeah, I'll give it up for seatbelts is all I got to say. When I was hanging upside down, I was thanking my lucky stars that I had my seatbelt on.
Then it's just back to normal. You started a new job this week as if nothing
happened. I know. I go to work and I need to tell them that I might need to take a call. You know, it's my first day and I'm like, I might need to take a call from the insurance agency because of this accident. Mm-hmm. And I showed my new chief and lieutenant the pictures and they were like, oh, yeah, you do what you need to do.
All right. So let's go back in time then. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, I think most of your guests sometimes say by accident, and mine truly was. I was working as a juvenile probation officer for the same county that I worked for, and I was stagnant in the job and you kind of get into this compassion fatigue when you're working with juvenile offenders and offenders overall, I guess. And so I was kind of looking for something, was on the website for our county because I had already put in 8 years with them. And so I was like, you know, I don't necessarily want to leave the county. And so I saw it as a bulletin for a crime analyst. And I was reading the job description. And I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting. Oh, wait, that sounds fun. You know, and I kept on going down the list and I was like, where do I sign up for this?
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting the job. I was the first crime analyst for the Fort Bend County Sheriff's Office, and it was actually a grant position. And the funny story about that is the sheriff at the time, he was opposed to getting this position because he's like, what is a crime analyst going to do? And by the end of the first or second week, he was already singing my praises. So
wow.
I was able to show him and the major at the time, who were total old school. I mean, both of them were, one of them was a former DPS Ranger and, very old school. They didn't understand what it could do. And then I literally was able to start showing some stuff like right out the gate. So I changed their minds very quickly.
So what were some things that you were able to bring to the table?
Well, I think one of the things is my whole juvenile justice experience. I was already up to date with law enforcement in general. So it wasn't like I was a rookie in the sense of not knowing the procedures and what police officers do and what deputies do and, how law enforcement occurs. So I think that helped me a lot. And then the second thing is the position was grant funded by Homeland Security. And so what happened was I was able to kind of go up and talk to one of the analysts at the Fusion Center. Let's see if I can get the acronym right. It's HRISC, which is the Houston Regional Information Sharing
Center.
Thank you. Yeah. And so, I was able to go up there and they had a staff analyst on the job that she's been doing some stuff. And so I was able to learn a little bit from her.
Was there a gap missing in intelligence between what the sheriff was getting and what you were able to bring to the table?
I think so. I think one of the things that I was able to plug in right away, the part of the grant, it was all about intel sharing. And so that was my main focus, was looking at our reports for suspicious activity reports as far as counterterrorism goes. And so I was able to, you know, start going through the reports like a crime analyst does, but I had to look at it kind of through two lenses, one as a crime analyst and two as a counterterrorism kind of liaison. And so, you know, our county's not as dangerous or as big as Harris County, where Houston is, but we still have some players involved in with counterterrorism. And so I had to kind of keep my eye on the ball with those things.
Back to the probation officer for a second. Let's just talk about your position there. You said you were there for 8 years.
So it's easier to go back in time. And my first job out of graduate school, I worked at a prison because I thought I wanted to be a warden. And okay. So I worked at an adult facility in the state of Tennessee, and I had written my master's thesis on the privatization of prisons. And okay. So I got a job, of course, with the company that I interviewed with. And so I went to work, found out fairly quickly that juvenile justice class I opted out of in college was starting to look a little bit better, because the offenders that you see once they get to the prison system, mm-hmm. you know, I was going to go save the world. And so, you know, they were pretty far along in the system. And so for someone as optimistic as I am, I was there for 2 years, and I was like, I wanted to kind of stay in the business, but I started looking at the juvenile justice side. And so I ended up getting a job with the state of Texas at a juvenile prison in West Texas. Did a couple years there. And then I moved to Sugar Land, Fort Bend County area, and took this job as a juvenile probation officer. My first assignment was mental health offenders. And these were the kids that probably wouldn't be in the system had it not been for their mental health needs. However, what some of them did was still horrific. So, you know, you couldn't just wipe it under the rug. And so it paired me with a therapist, and we kind of attacked the kind of situation together and try to help the juvenile. And then after I did that for a couple of years, I went into the intensive supervision probation, which is basically the more high risk, the ones that are there for, you know, attempted murder or attempted robbery, ag assault, those types of things. And so I was the probation officer for them.
Back to the private prison, because that piqued my interest. Looking back now, I mean, you weren't there that long, but you still have 26 years of law enforcement experience. What's your take now on the idea of private prisons?
Oh, it's very easily said. I'll tell you, privatization of prisons works with adults, but does not work with juveniles. I kind of glossed over a segment where I was actually, I worked for the private sector at a kind of a treatment center, mm-hmm. juvenile prison. And cost cutting is something that you really can't do at the juvenile level. You know, what they did at the adult level was fantastic. I mean, you know, we had an incident on our campus at the prison where some inmates, they were making homemade wine. You know, mm-hmm. they call it julep. There's different names for it. But within a day, my warden was able to switch all of our, you know, because by law, they have to have so many nutrients and a dessert and all this stuff. And so they were able to, after this big, huge incident, we were able to pivot really quickly, and they got all pre-sweetened cake mixes and things like that. They took all the sugar out of the place, and only pre-sweetened things were available. And so that doesn't happen at a state government level. Nothing moves that fast.
Back to the probation officer then for juveniles. I think all of us have a vision of what a juvenile probation officer does. So tell me something that maybe would either surprise me or is a misnomer for juvenile probation officer.
That's a good question. I think one of the things that people, a lot of these kids just do bad things. I think we can all think back to our juvenile days and realize that we might not have been fortunate enough not to get caught. Mm-hmm. And also lived in a time where reporting of things, you know, you might have got sent home by the police officer as opposed to taken to juvenile detention. And so I think a lot of these kids, I mean, some of them are very small crime. In fact, the weirdest part was when I worked at the juvenile prison, we actually had offenders there, and I worked at a female unit. We had females there for what's called a CHINS violation, child in need of supervision. And so they were basically there for being too truant, and they were thrown into prison.
Aww.
Yeah. And so I think part of the thing with the juveniles is, you know, it depends on what kind of supervision level, whether it's a weekly visit by the probation officer, like in the intensive, they had to come into the office every week and do a urinalysis. We talked about things. I was able to give them sanctions if they, you know, misbehave. I was also able to take them back to court if I felt that the judge needed to hear about it. And I also went to their school each week during session and basically met with them there so I could get a report from what happens, you know, when they're at the school. And so they saw me a few times a week when they're on the intensive supervision.
So then you become the analyst. We'll fast forward now back to you becoming an analyst then. So I can see it being an advantage for you to not only be in the same sheriff's office, you had experience working with police officers. You have this experience working with the juveniles in this area. So what were some of the things that this experience as a juvenile probation officer helped you be a better analyst when you started?
I think one of the things that people don't always realize when they're talking about juveniles is they can't help themselves but to leave their footprints in a lot of places. And so I think having the mindset of working with juvenile delinquents, I was able to kind of see what their modus operandi, their MO was, and be able to kind of put that together faster than maybe a crime analyst that was just getting started.
What were some of the issues in the beginning that you were trying to tackle?
Part of it was the old boy network of, you know, we didn't really need you. And so you kind of have to prove yourself in different ways and basically try to bring things. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm learning all this. And so it's like, I'm trying to bring things. And for example, we had a big series about a group of Colombian nationals breaking into houses in a particular way. And so, you know, I was able to see this MO develop and be able to bring that to the team and basically say, if we can tell patrol to kind of look out for this type of entry, then we might be able to get some more information on these things. And so trying to fight's not really the right word, but try to convince the powers to be that, you know, we can ask other questions when we're out in the field.
So then were you more out in the field than maybe most analysts that you knew, or was it yours is still mostly behind the desk?
It was still mostly behind the desk, but I made it a point to go to briefings. I developed, you know, a couple of slide decks to explain the act of jugging or what the Colombians' MO was. And so I was a little bit putting myself out there as far as going to briefings and trying to get heard. And I think what analysts think about all the time is the amount of information that is not written into the report or not put into the little tabs on our RMS system. And so I would just encourage them. In fact, I would email, if I saw one that did it well, I would email the deputy and his supervisor and kind of applaud him for that or her and basically keep up the good work because it was helping me in my job.
Now, did you have a focus per se, or?
I was mainly left to my own devices, which is another story, but but I'm kind of an independent worker. And so I kind of geared myself into those things. And when I saw things, I would work with the burglary and theft, you know, detectives and kind of bring up things and, you know, and then we would kind of try to mash our notes together. I don't know what the word is, but we would, you know, I would kind of try to work with them as a team to try to see what they're seeing out there and what they're, and also asking them to ask the victims follow-up questions. Like we had incidents where we had people getting burglarized in the evening time, which is very unusual. And we found out that the series was going on where they were running, the bad guys were running license plate through an app at restaurants, at fancy restaurants. Well, fancy is not the right word. At restaurants where people of international descent go to eat. And what Americans kind of forget is we eat and we're out the door in like 30 minutes or less. But a lot of international people will eat for hours. And one of the things that Fort Bend is most proud of is its diversity. And so what the bad guys realized was these people would go out to eat and they would be gone for a long time from their residence. And so they would use that time and send another set of bad guys to the house to burglarize while the other people were eating dinner.
Man, that's actually clever. I mean, it's awful. It's awful. Don't get me wrong, but that is actually clever.
Yeah, I'm telling you. I mean, it was the detectives and with us figuring out what kind of entry they're making. And it was asking the follow-up questions to the victims of, were you out to eat? You know, those were things that we had to bring to the deputies taking the reports to try to get them to ask. And it worked because we were able to solve a lot of crimes get trackers on vehicles by figuring some of this stuff out.
So was there information online somewhere to where they could then find their address?
Yeah, it's crazy. There is a app, and I didn't know I was going to tell that story. So I didn't think, I think it's like public data. Like, but you pay. And of course, they're bad guys. So they're using someone else's credit card. So it's not like they're out any skins. Yeah. But you can actually pay to run a license plate and get their information.
Oh, okay.
And so that's what the these bad guys would do. And then they would have another team just go out to the residence and hit the house.
So then was there a particular training that you had during this time that you really felt was helpful? Because you're coming in new to the
profession. I'm coming in brand new. You're absolutely right. I think what I was fortunate enough, because I was on this grant, I had a healthy training budget. And so I used that to my full advantage. In my first year, I went to the IACA conference, what happened to be in Texas that year. So I went there to Arlington. I went to a mapping. We had a local mapping called Teach Me GIS here in Houston. And I took one of those classes. And so I kind of learned how to map that way. I took a crystal report training and kind of learned how to do the extractions from the RMS system and kept on, training. I was very fortunate enough with my training budget to be able to get myself to where I am.
Are you doing any regular reporting? More of a crime analysis type reporting where you're reporting on doing the bean counting. Did you eventually have to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I got bogged down with open records requests. I became the catch-all as the years go on, as I think a lot of analysts do. If they don't know something, they'll ask for HOA meetings or for a newspaper or TV channel asking for stats. I was trying to help the patrol unit with running their numbers as far as where they are, what district they are, and where they're running to. And so all of it was just out of the side pocket. I mean, none of it was organized in my brain.
So this brings us to your badge story. And for those that are new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that an analyst works. For you, Krista, this deals with a series of burglaries of Chick-fil-A's.
Yeah, we called it Operation Foul Play.
Nice. Well played.
Thank you. Thank you. The quick backstory is Chick-fil-A's happen to be, if you're in a county, you might have two or three. But if you're in a single municipality, you might only have one. And so it's hard to put all these incidents together. And so what happened was, the major came to me. It was January 5th, 2016. And I remember that because he comes to me and he sits down and he's like, Sheriff got an email from this Chick-fil-A guy and says, there's all these burglaries happening and he's afraid he's going to be next. And I'm like, there's no way. If there is a burglary series going on, by this time, I feel like I'm tapped in a little bit,
Yes.
I've been on the job a little bit. And so I'm like, no, there's no way, if there was something going on, I would know about it. And so, I had to eat those words. and so what happened, he gave me the proprietor's phone number. So I ended up calling him, which is kind of unusual, I think, for a crime analyst. I actually called a potential victim and he was telling me about this stuff. And he ended up giving me the phone number to the Chick-fil-A corporate protection services number. And he says, talk to this guy. He can tell you more about it. And so I'm like, this is not really in my wheelhouse.
But sure.
I go ahead and do it. And I end up talking to this guy. And he said at the time he had already like 10 different incidents all over Houston where people were breaking into Chick-fil-A through their, well, in multiple ways, but mainly through the drive-through window.
Okay.
And they ended up, they're going into their smart safe where they keep all the money. And you know, sure, if you've ever been to a Chick-fil-A, and I don't know if they're, you know, national, but they take money hand over fist because everyone loves Chick-fil-A. They're so nice to everybody. And so what was happening was they were breaking into these places and just using grinders to get into the safe.
Okay.
So I figured out we had one on New Year's Day, but it was an attempted one. And I was like, you know, I don't see anybody else. So I put out an alert to some of the people I knew and said, hey, have you guys had anything like this? One of the detectives in a neighboring agency, Katy Police Department, said that they just had one that the day before. And so I started working with that detective. And while he was actually working his case, I was working with the protection services from Chick-fil-A. And they basically sent me a spreadsheet of all the incidents that they've had. And they had already had like 20 incidents.
Now, were these all reported?
Yeah, but they were reported to one, two. I tried to write down some of them. You know, Harris County, HPD, Dickinson Police Department, Webster, Fort Bend County, Baytown, KDPD, Cyfair. So they were all in these million different jurisdictions.
Okay.
And so what happened was we didn't have any way. If I only have one, I don't have a series. And so basically I was like, so now I know the KD guy had one. And now I get a spreadsheet from Chick-fil-A corporate of all these other ones. So I tried to email and call some of my analyst friends from some of these other jurisdictions and say, hey, do you have any of these Chick-fil-A things? You know, they'll look. But what happened is sometimes they were coded as a burglary. Sometimes they were coded as attempted burglary. Sometimes they were coded as a criminal mischief. And so they were all over the place. But yet at the same time, they were still all attacking the one business. Sure. And so I was able to put all those together, got all the reports from all the different agencies and kind of came up with the time series and figuring out when they were doing it. When Chick-fil-A makes all their money on Saturday, they don't go to the bank until Monday. And so what they were doing was they were breaking in either Saturday night or Sunday in the wee hours, and all that day's cash was there because they apparently the proprietors did not make a deposit on Saturday because they had been, you know, they were so busy on Saturday.
Sure.
And so they were getting tons of money. So between me and the Katie detective, who, this is awesome, some of the, you know, and we don't get this a lot, but some of the surveillance cameras had audio.
Okay.
And so the one in Katy actually had audio, and the detective listened to the audio and was able to find out that the bad guy spy went to a nearby Whataburger. He was there, and then police officers came there. And so he was kind of giving his buddies a heads up. Hey, there's a cop over here. Well, the detective went there and the bad guy ended up using his debit card to make that purchase. That's called a clue.
Yeah.
So we were able to, and so we eventually got some suspects from him, just kind of, you know, who his associates were. And we were able to get a area attack team on for surveillance. Well, all during this time, I've been updating my little bulletin about what's going on and how these guys are doing it. And the extent to these people going, they were, if you ever imagine, they were walking on the countertops to avoid the lasers. And they would bring a sheet to drape over when they're trying to grind into these safes. So these guys were there for long periods of time. They were there for a couple hours. They brought their own grinder in their backpack. And so we were able to kind of use some of these clues and send them out around town. And so long story short, one night we had, you know, we had the tech team on them. They were doing surveillance and they went to a Chick-fil-A. And so they're like, yes, we got them. Because of all the bulletins we had been sending out, there was actually a proactive officer doing his normal, writing his report in a Chick-fil-A parking lot just to provide that protection.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad guys moved on and they ended up going to a bar, which they were also known to do. And they forced entry and the tech team was able to take them down. But in the end, all these different jurisdictions were able to know who the suspects were. And in total financial loss from Chick-fil-A was $1.2 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, Yeah. And so they gave me a party. So if Chick-fil-A throws you a party, it's kind of a big deal. So they sent me this big flower bouquet. I mean, it's the biggest flower bouquet I've ever seen. They actually had to put it on our Facebook page because they were really thankful for what we were doing. And then they brought the mascot in and gave us all lunch and gave us some cards. I don't have Chick-fil-A for life. I wish I did, but that was a big case for us.
I think Chick-fil-A is nationwide now. You talked about their popularity. They're so popular now that most of the ones they're knocking down the building and putting in this double drive-through.
Oh, I know. Thing. I've seen it.
And it's, that seems to be the way to go. But it's fascinating to me. I'm thinking as you're telling this story, you only have so many Chick-fil-A's. So did you get to the point where you could do some predictive analysis? Like, okay, this one hasn't been hit yet. And that might be a potential spot where they might hit next.
Yeah. In fact, some of the agencies, you know, we have one of our neighboring agencies, Rosenberg Police Department, had not had one. And we already had ours. Katie had theirs. And so they actually set up and they did their own undercover surveillance at that restaurant. I didn't really get to say the next hit's going to be here, but I was able to say on a Sunday, not, you know, Saturday and Sunday, make sure someone's checking their Chick-fil-A's, you know, on close patrol or, you know, and make sure you're looking at the drive-through window. Just don't look at it. And also they would break the lower window in the children's play area, which those big panels, not all of them had sensors on it. And so these are operational things that they learned as being victims, not all, you know, like the front door, of course, has a sensor, but sure. You don't think those big panels where the playground is to have a sensor on it. Those were some of the things that we were able to tell the people to look for.
If you're not familiar with Chick-fil-A, their national policy is not to be open on Sundays, which
correct.
I always think of like how much money they lose by not being open on Sunday. Like,
it's, yeah. And that's okay. I mean, I applaud them for them doing that. I remember they have those, some of those in the mall, and the mall doesn't let anyone be closed on Sunday. But yeah. You know, I think Chick-fil-A basically said, this is when our people can be with their families. Mm-hmm. And there's other businesses that do that. And anyone that takes a stand and say, you know, we're willing to lose money to let our workers have a family day off. That's awesome.
So was this group of burglars, did they have inside information? Did some of them work at Chick-fil-A's to get to know some of the layout, to know what to do and what not to do?
I don't know the answer to that. I tried to keep up with the case. The three people that were mainly responsible for it, I don't think they had a work history at all. So they might have known someone that had some information, but they definitely did not work there.
Before we move on to you leaving and starting your new job this week, I have one last question for you. So in your time there as an analyst, you started out as a juvenile probation officer. Did you ever get a situation where you were unfortunate to meet some of the people that you've met as a juvenile, but then were still doing crimes later as an adult?
Yeah, that's actually funny. There has been cases where one of the detectives would come to me and say, hey, you know, can you get me a picture of so-and-so from juvenile? And I'd be, yeah, okay. And then it would be someone I would know. And then most recently, we had a big case where it was a former juvenile that was involved in a big crime. And so, yeah, that happened a couple occasions. It was like, oh, I don't want to ever see those names again, but you can't help them all.
So let's talk about what you're doing now. You retired from the sheriff's office and then have now quickly took in another job.
So in Texas, and I'm not sure what it is nationally, but in Texas, our school districts, if they're large enough, they can have their own police department. Instead of having like a resource officer from the sheriff's office or something like that, they have their own PD. And so the chief over there at Fort Bend ISD, which is one of the largest school districts in the state of Texas, I think it's like the eighth largest. They remodeled, they had a bond election, and they were able to create what they're calling an operations center. He wanted a fusion center within their police department. And so he kind of recruited me over to there. I'm going to help them set up crime analysis, intel analysis, and everything in between. Yesterday, I got this video board that is bigger than a football field, it seems like. And schools have a lot of cameras, over 6,000 in this school district. And so being able to pull those up and try to learn learn those systems and try to be able to be quick to help the police officers responding to an incident is going to be kind of what I'm going to be doing here in the first time. And then also I'm hoping to bring a little bit of real-time crime into their dispatch. I'm located adjacent to the dispatch center. And so I think we'll be able to do a little bit of real-time. If an incident's going down, I can be able to feed them some information.
Okay. And then what's your area of concentration?
Fort Bend County is a very large school district. It has, from what I've learned, 80,000 students. And they have about 80 schools. And so my jurisdiction is just those schools and the adjacent properties, for example, the annex, the police departments. So we're really limited as far as our jurisdiction. When I was getting ready to start over there, I queried our analyst forum. There's some other people doing similar things down in Florida. Those were the other places that had analysts at school districts. And so I was able to reach out to them and kind of learn a little bit about what they're doing there. It kind of gave me a little footing.
As you mentioned in the beginning, juveniles don't always make the best decisions in the world. So I'm sure you'll be busy.
Yeah, exactly.
Hello, I'm Barry Fosberg, the senior analyst with Houston Police Department. I'm here to do a PSA for regional associations. If you're an IACA or familiar with IACA, get in, find out if you have a local association. And if for no other reason, your crooks don't know you have borders, your borders typically have other crime analysts, and this is a great way to know them by name.
We have a new announcement. As of the fourth Thursday of every month, ASIO are going to be publishing new content, and this will be focusing on crime analysis within Uganda, but also Africa as a whole. My colleague and friend, Emmanuel James Oteng, will be hosting these podcasts, and further information about these will be discussed next by Emmanuel. So keep your eye out for the new Crime Analysis Between the Tropics podcast.
Formerly an intelligence analyst in the UK, and now working and training others in Africa, I've joined with ACIA and LEAP to present our Africa series of podcasts. We aim to bridge understanding between Africa and the rest of the analytical world. With shared thought and a common lexicon, we aim to broaden the analysts' worldviews, mitigate cognitive bias, refine analytical tradecraft, and improve investigative outcomes everywhere. This is Emmanuel James Oteng, and I invite you to visit leappodcast.com on the fourth Thursday of the month, starting from 12th November, and listen to my podcast there. Analysis improves through exchange.
Well, let's get some advice you have for our listeners. You know, some of the questions that I have usually deal with what analysts can study today that may be important 5 years from now.
One of the things that when you posed that question, the first thing I kind of thought of was what we term OSINT, which is open source information. But I think we need to start narrowing that down to what's called SOSINT, which is social intelligence investigations. Right now, the age bracket of most of our crime in general, 18 to 25 year olds, they've been completely raised in social media. When they were 13, they made an account that wasn't legal for them to have. And they said they were 18 when they were 14, and now they're of age, and now they're, creeping up on 25, and they've always had a Facebook. They've always, and then they moved on to Instagram and Snapchat and now TikTok. And sure. So I think one of the things that at work caused some of our detectives problems is because the detective didn't do social media for themselves, they were in a handicapped position to actually investigate their crimes because they didn't know how to navigate those resources. And so I think as people kind of come into it, we really have to look at the social intelligence and the social media specifically, and not just open source can go into fraud and things like that. And that's a lot of different people have those jobs. But as far as actual tactical stuff, I think social intelligence is kind of where we need to start focusing our time. Like all these TikTok challenges coming up, I'm going to have to step up my TikTok game.
Yeah, get some 13, 14 year old interns. right?
I know. Well, see, I used to count on my niece, but she's 20 now. And so she doesn't, you know, I have to go younger.
Yeah.
I need to have a 13-year-old on standby.
Do you feel that these folks are more savvy now? Because as you mentioned, they grew up with it. But there was a point in time where a lot of folks didn't realize that when they took a picture, the lat long or the location was embedded in the data there. So that unless you physically turned it off on your phone, they could get the location of the photo. And then there was a point in time where people didn't realize that their locations were on in period in terms of their phones, so they could be tracked. So it seems to me that as people get caught doing stuff, using the phones, using social media, there should be this curve to lessons learned and people realizing that they can't do it and their workarounds. So they should be getting more savvy with this stuff. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, definitely. For example, we had a big homicide case, and out of probably 6 different Snapchat accounts we got subpoenaed, only one of them had their geolocations on. And so those are things that they are getting smarter. And so, you know, you have to work that much harder. And the other thing is, you know, we talk about CDR records, but what's happening now is they're using the voice over IP. They're using Instagram to make calls. They're using Snapchat to make calls, and they're never touching a tower.
Yes. You know, same thing. They're doing something similar with texting too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, right. WhatsApp, Signal, all those, I mean, you know, they're locked down pretty hard, and you have to look for the crack in the, you know, the crack, you know, someone who didn't do that and try to exploit it.
You could literally spend your whole time in TikTok. Do you realize that?
Oh, I know. I try not to look at it for personal. Yeah. I try to just save it for work.
Yeah. You're just going to need one person dedicated to TikTok until the next greatest thing comes out. It is funny how it seems to happen with, not generationally, but it does seem like it gets to the point where these platforms, they lose their novelty. Some people use them for so long and then it's not cool to use them anymore. Right.
Yes. Yeah, because so Facebook, of course, isn't cool anymore. So that's where you find all the parents.
Yes. Yeah. What it was, you know, YouTube at one point in time, and then it was Vine at one point in time. And now it seems TikTok's the flavor of the month. It'll be something early next year, probably moving on.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's part of the point of being able to be in that social media intelligence is being able to be open to it. The fact that some of the people, you know, just because you don't do it personally doesn't mean your investigations can't benefit from your knowledge of it.
Yeah, no, it definitely is something. I even, when we went for the podcast, I had to figure out, luckily I have somebody does it for me doing Twitter, because I personally don't use Twitter. I've never actually been on there, but I know it's important. So a lot of this stuff is, I'm old man elder about a lot of this stuff. Oh. I was like, oh, this seems like such a waste of time. Like, I don't need to be doing that.
Exactly. No, I agree with you. It's crazy. And I mean, the fact that I can show my age, I'm kind of on the other side of some of these things. And I'm like, I can't believe I'm looking at this stuff.
Let's move on now, because I do want to talk about you helping to set up local associations there in Houston. You had an influence on both the Greater Houston Law Enforcement Analysts, as well as the Texas Law Enforcement Analyst Network. Just talk a little bit about those, how those came to be, what your role was in helping get them started, and what their purposes are.
Great. So it actually follows my badge story. The fact that no one was able to pick up and I didn't have contacts in all these different locations, I kind of was thinking to myself, and there's a great analyst in at HPD named Barry Fosberg, who kind of had this idea that we should get together and talk about what's going on beyond our jurisdiction. I told Barry, I went to one of his meetings and I kind of stole the idea from him and I took it and ran with it. And he'll give me credit. Yeah. He's a great guy. I sent out a survey in May to some analysts that I knew and say, hey, are you interested in forming something like this? It'd be informal. We would just get together for what I was kind of calling a regional analyst meeting, you know, a brown bag lunch. Mm-hmm. Let's get together at lunchtime and talk about what's going on in our jurisdictions. And so did one of those SurveyMonkey surveys. I got some traction with that. And so we kind of set up our first meeting. My now friend, Kimber Reese-Birch over at Harris County, she was able to offer up her location. And then between me, her, and Mike Jackson from Sugarland PD, we came up with this monthly meeting. And we would try to decide to like educate ourselves, train each other. Like if I've been to a conference or a meeting, kind of share what I learned, talk mm-hmm. about some crime trends, but some of it was just contact building. And sure. so we were able to, I mean, we've been going since 2016 and we have a Google group that we have. And so we can share information and more importantly, contacts. Like if you need a report from another agency, you don't have to go through records. And I should have looked before this call, but we have like 80 members at least.
Oh, that was my question. Yeah.
Yeah, we have at least 80. I mean, we have people, you know, whether they're police officers, we were able to get traction with. We actually had a district attorney, an assistant district attorney, and a couple of her coworkers got involved. And they were able to, you know, kind of present some stuff on their side. Through COVID, unfortunately, we kind of had to stop our meeting in person, but we're hoping to pick up again. But, you know, we're pretty proud of this. We kind of have Montgomery County, Fourpen County, Harris County, Galveston County, all the different counties within the Houston area. And that's, we've been able to kind of come together and be able to share information and share contacts and share booking photos and things that, you know, normally would take a little bit longer are now just as quick as an email.
Nice. Well done.
And then with the text lien, I got a call from Alex Schneider and Mindy Earle. They were kind of forming a steering committee in the same year, 2016. And I guess they got my name. And so we met, I drove up to the Dallas-Fort Worth area and we kind of had a big lunch and kind of talked about it and brainstormed. We kind of formed that and it kind of became effective in 2017. Okay. And I was the first secretary for them. Obviously with Texas being as big as it is, I think it kind of meets some of the challenges that California has as far as vastness. But in that short period of time, we were able to have at least 3 in-person symposiums, if you will. And I was able to have one at the sheriff's office, which was very nice because we had a good training facility. And so we got a lot of good speakers in and things like that. So it's been pretty successful. And I think Texas had one many years ago. And then it just kind of pittered out. And I think the hard part is with these associations is you get some people that really want to help. And then you get some people that really want to benefit from it. And so, but it takes everybody.
Sure. It's about setting up a routine, just like anything else, right? And getting everybody on board and having people stay with their position long enough to really Correct. Get established. And it's funny, you mentioned the size of Texas, and that was the first thing that I thought of. I know here in Florida, the Florida Association, if it's in northern Florida, their conference, people from the south don't go. And if it's in the right. south, people from the north don't go. Texas, geez, from one end to the other, right? That can be like, what,
it's 10 hours.
10, 12 hours?
Yeah, 10, I think it's 10 to 12 hours if you go from El Paso to the east side.
Yes, so that's just crazy. But
it is.
So, well, I think that's good. Texas should have one. They should have, they did definitely have the footprint for it. And hopefully it gets established and, you know, you start doing the things that associations do, hold elections and have conferences and have training on a regular basis and then get a little bit more complex from there.
Yeah, we've been actually good. We've been going pretty strong. We've had two different rounds of elections. And so I think we're well on the road. It's just a matter of, like I said, distance might be a problem as actually getting people in, but we've been trying to do some stuff to get some bulletins shared and throughout the state and things like that to make it a little bit more secure sending stuff. But I think we might have the second largest population with the IACA feeder group right now, second or third for sure.
Yeah. I've thought about this a little bit because I know they've recently started the regional committee that represents all the different regional associations. Seems to me, though, that if you get a new member to the IACA that's from Texas, it seems to me they automatically should be part of the regional association. I know there's different money, you know, there's the IACA fund and then there's the local association, but it does seem like that new analyst or that new member should automatically be tied to the local regional association.
That would be great. I mean, what we do is if someone comes in at the regional level, we get them tied in with IACA. Mm-hmm. So it would be very beneficial if the IACA could return the favor and say, hey, I noticed you're from Texas. Let me get you in contact with these people because your same $25 can pay for both. You know, sure. That's the benefit of having a regional is, you know, they give you a discount because you're part of the regional into the IACA. So that same $25 you're paying independently can now be used for two associations.
Yeah. I want to have Glenn Mills on because he's awesome. the chair of the regional committee.
Yeah, that'd
there.
Be great.
So pick his brain and get, he's also very funny and entertaining. So he'll be a good.
Oh, he definitely is. I've taken a few of his classes.
All right, then. So let's move on to personal interest then. And as I mentioned in your intro, you're a bourbon fan. So how did you become a bourbon fan? And do you have a particular bourbon that is your go-to?
Well, you know, I was a wine drinker for a long, long time. And mm-hmm. I think it might've been my brother-in-law, Dave. He was a bourbon fan first. And so I think we've gotten him gifts, you know, over the years. And so finally I was like, let me try this stuff. And so I tasted it and it was, you know, awesome. And just to let the audience know, this recording is after hours. So I do have one in my glass.
Well played.
Thank you. I just wanted to put that out there that this is an after hours session. So, but I started small, you know, went through, you know, all the transitions. I've been probably a bourbon drinker for probably, I don't say 10 years, but you know, 6 or 7 years now. I've been to several distilleries. I've tried many different kinds and the nice thing about bourbon is it has to be made in a very specific way.
Sure.
And so you get a very consistent flavor profile. I mean, some of them do it better than others for sure, but you know, it's not like wine can, you know, you can have very vastly different types of wine, but when you're going to pour a glass of bourbon, it's pretty much going to be in this flavor profile.
Good. So what's your go-to?
It depends. My favorite is one that I can't get locally. My sister lives in Kentucky, and which of course is the bourbon capital of the world. And there is this one called, oh God, now I'm having a blank. Hold on. New Riff. And it's actually right on the Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky border. It's in Covington. And since you are from that area, you probably know where.
Yeah, I know exactly where you're talking about.
It's really good. Their whole thing is kind of doing bourbon on a new riff on an old style. I make sure my sister brings me a bottle every time she comes here. It's not quite big enough that it's distributed down here. Mm-hmm. And so I treasure each bottle I get, but I think it's the history of it, you know, and things like that, that kind of draw me to it.
Sure. I do highly recommend to the audience going to a distillery and getting a tour, especially if you can go visit there in Kentucky. There's some, they got, not only do they have the bourbon area there, but they've got a great set of caves there as well. So it's quite an adventure going in there to Kentucky. You can go down into several of the caves there, plus then go to the Jim Beam Distillery.
And that'd be a good one.
That was a fascinating experience.
I went to the Woodford one and the Buffalo Trace. And then we did the New Riff. And what I liked about each of them was they were so different. The New Riff is kind of an urban distillery. And the Woodford, it looks like a college campus. I mean, you look like it's the quintessential. I mean, it's green, you know, that Kentucky bluegrass, you know, the fencing of the stables. And then Buffalo Trace is like there in the heart of their capital. And it's very industrial, but they put out some good stuff.
So how do you normally drink it? Do you drink it straight on the rocks? How do you know where you're drinking?
Yes. It depends. During the week, it's usually just straight with a large ice cube. On the weekends, I like to make cocktails. Manhattan is my favorite, but I'll do an old fashioned if I feel like having something sweet.
Yeah, I was on an old fashioned kick earlier this year.
Oh, yeah.
Man, nice. It's just good. Now, like how do you feel about the flavored phenomenon now with some of this, especially like Jim Beam? So now they got honey and cinnamon and peach and apple.
No. I'm old school. There's a lot of things about me that are very progressive, but not bourbon. The thing about bourbon is you're not supposed to add anything to it. And so the purity of that, I mean, you're not even supposed to add anything but water to it. And so when they add it, it's not bourbon anymore. It can be whiskey, but it's not bourbon.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, very good. So our last segment to the show is Words of the World. And this is where I give the guest the last word and you can promote any idea that you wish. Krista, what are your words to the world?
Be kind and be compassionate. Miller Williams is a poet and he wrote this poem about compassion. And basically, he reminds us to have compassion because we don't know what wars are going on where the spirit meets the bone. And that's kind of been my motto as far as dealing with people, especially during COVID. I mean, we don't know what people have been going through in those last 2 years, but have some respect for each other and just be kind and be compassionate.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Thank you.
I do appreciate you being on the show, Krista. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.